United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group, says that it is continuing to review a ceasefire plan in Gaza put forth by Israel following a visit to Israel by an Egyptian delegation, where officials described a new vision for a prolonged end to hostilities. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
Another night of protests in Tel Aviv as hundreds call for new elections and the ouster of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters say Netanyahu's government isn't doing enough to bring home the hostages, despite him recently having said Israel will increase both political and military pressure on Hamas. Hamas's military wing released a video over the weekend that appears to show hostages Keith Siegel and Omri Meron sending messages to their families as the Jewish holiday Passover draws to a close at the end of April. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
The amount of humanitarian aid going into Gaza Strip will be ramped up in coming days, according to Israel's military, citing new corridors they use in Israeli seaport and border crossings into the Palestinian enclave.
Food, water, medical supplies, shelter equipment, and other aid. More of it is going into Gaza than ever before. This increase in aid is a result of increased efforts.
That's Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. After closing off access to Gaza following the Hamas attack on October 7th that set off the war, Israel has since allowed in aid convoys amid growing international pressure to boost the amount of supplies to feed Gaza's 2.3 million people. Separately, U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen said it would resume operations in the Gaza Strip on Monday, a month after seven of its workers were killed in an Israeli airstrike. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday issued a fresh plea to the international community to hurry up and deliver more air defenses, start formal talks for his country to enter the European Union, and invite Ukraine to join NATO. Ukrainian forces face a worsening position in the east and await delivery of U.S. weapons following the April 23rd approval by Congress of a $61 billion aid package after months of delay. Zelensky has repeatedly pleaded for further air defense systems, particularly the Patriot system. Meanwhile, Ukraine's army chief says its troops have been forced to retreat from three villages in the country's embattled east. And Colonel General Oleksandr Syrsky warned of a worsening battlefield situation as Ukrainian forces wait for much-needed arms from a huge U.S. aid package to reach combat zones. He reported Sunday that Russian forces continue to attack along the entire front line of more than 1,000 kilometers or 620 miles. Germany's coup suspects go on trial. Details from VOA's Joe Ramsey.
Nine men go on trial in Germany on Monday, charged with high treason, attempted murder, and plotting a violent coup aimed at installing an aristocrat as national leader and imposing martial law. The hearing in a maximum security courtroom marks the start of three marathon trials of 27 people in total accused of conspiring in a plot foiled by authorities at the end of 2022. Together, they amount to one of the largest legal proceedings in German history. Monday's trial focuses on nine suspects, members of a group who allegedly aimed to impose harsh military law on Germany after carrying out a coup. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
U.S. intelligence officials have determined that Russian President Vladimir Putin likely did not order the death of imprisoned opposition leader Alexei Navalny in February. An official says the U.S. intelligence community has found no smoking gun that Putin was aware of the timing of Navalny's death or directly ordered it. The official says it's believed Putin was ultimately responsible for the death of Navalny, who endured brutal conditions during his confinement. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive matter. Navalny was Russia's best-known opposition politician and died while serving a 19-year sentence on extremism charges that he called politically motivated. A month later, Putin won re-election. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Tony Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, April 29, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togolese voters cast their ballots today, Monday, in an election that could be a referendum on a controversial constitutional reform.
The result of the legislative and regional election will show us what is the position of the Togolese population. If the Togolese population gives the majority to the opposition, we will accept it.
A new digital ethics organization aims to help journalists and activists identify false and misleading information. Kenya will host peace talks soon between the South Sudan government and so-called holdout armed groups. Sierra Leone's president takes control of the ministry, the country's Ministry of Energy, amid an electricity crisis. The UN says conflicts, extreme weather, and economic shocks are worsening global food insecurity.
Underlying issue with this report is the acute food and nutrition insecurity that we're facing. And it's due to conflict, and a lot of that conflict is due to climate change issues.
And flooding continues to wreak havoc on parts of Kenya. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togolese voters are casting their ballots today, Monday, to elect members of parliament and regional representatives. The vote could be a referendum on the controversial constitutional reform adopted this month, which allows for the president to be elected by parliament. A key opposition leader told VOA last week that its opponents will resume protests because the revised constitution is intended to keep in power President Faure Gnassingbé, who, together with his late father, have ruled Togo for over 50 years. Gilbert Bawera is the Togolese Minister for Civil Service, Labor, and Social Dialogue. He tells me that Togolese voters will have the final say about the new constitution when they cast their ballots today, Monday.
First of all, I want to express our satisfaction that the campaign went on very well, not only in the capital Lomé, but all over the country, all the stakeholders, the political parties, the independent candidates, everyone was able to run the campaign without any incident. We highly appreciate the behavior of the population, of the citizens, of the political actors, and also of the security services. So we hope the voting will proceed today in the same condition of peace, of security and serenity.
I did speak with the main opposition leader, Jean-Pierre Fabre, about this new constitution. And he's saying that the opposition will never accept this new constitution because, according to him, it's a constitution that is intended to maintain President Faure Gnassingbé in power.
First of all, I hope that Mr. Jean-Pierre Fabre and all other political actors, they are completely and totally aware that we went to the legislative and regional elections on the basis of the new constitution. It means that the next president of the republic, who will be also the head of the government, they will be elected the first one by the Senate together with the National Assembly, and later only by the majority in the National Assembly. So we will see, they have the opportunity to campaign, to explain to the citizens and to the population what are the reasons why they are opposed to the new constitution. And we have also explained to the population the benefit and advantages of this new constitution. So the result of the legislative and regional election will show us what is the position of the Togolese population. So if the Togolese population give the majority to the opposition, so we will accept it. If the population give the majority to our party, UNI, we hope that they will also accept it. We trust the population and we will abide by the decision and the vote of the Togolese population. After they have been explained why it was necessary to have a new constitution to make sure that the power is shared among many actors instead of concentrating the power in the hand of one person. So we will see what the population will have decided, because we have explained to the population that by voting today, if they vote for us, it means their agreement with the new constitution. If they don't give us the majority, then we will see that the Togolese doesn't want the new constitution.
Gilbert Bawara is the Togolese Minister for Civil Servants, Labor and Social Dialogue. He is also a prominent member of the ruling union for the Republican Party. He was speaking with us from the Togolese capital, Lomé. At least 16 African countries, including South Africa, will hold elections in the remaining months of 2024. Pro-democracy activists say voters who go online for political news are risking exposure to disinformation and misinformation. But a new digital ethics organization aims to help journalists and activists identify false and misleading content so that they can educate the public. Zahir Kasim has the story from Johannesburg.
In the upcoming general elections of 2026.
At first glance, this video of Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema announcing that he won't be running in the next election seems authentic, but it's fake. And these journalists in Johannesburg are learning how to spot the difference with the help from a non-profit called Campaign on Digital Ethics, or CODE. Kavisha Pillay is the founding director of CODE.
We're making sure that people are accessing information that is safe and is not going to be harmful, that the technology that we're using is not going to cause further harms to our society.
Working with CODE on this project is Africa Check, one of the continent's leading independent fact-checking organizations. The staff at Africa Check encourage people to send their suspicious content. They're collaborating with CODE to teach the public how to identify fake social media content.
It helps to have not just someone to step in and do some work checking that kind of information, but also to be able to share tips and tricks and techniques for stepping in to stop that spread with anyone.
Community activist Manny Sigomani will be on high alert in the days leading to South Africa's May 29th elections, on the lookout for any fake content that might affect his ward.
I think we're moving into an era where more and more the truth is being distorted. And we kind of need these kind of initiatives to keep people grounded and to keep people responsible.
The Independent Electoral Commission of South Africa has announced it will work with Google, Meta and TikTok to help safeguard the integrity of the electoral process. Siri Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
A South Sudan official has confirmed that Kenya will host peace talks soon between the government and so-called holdout armed groups. The holdouts are those yet to ratify the 2018 revitalized comprehensive peace agreement. The talks have been taking place in recent years in Rome. Nathaniel Oyet Piorino is the deputy chairman of the SPLMIO that is led by South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar. He tells me that he's disappointed that the Kenyan mediator who visited Juba over the weekend did not meet with Machar, who also plays a key role in the revitalized transitional government of national unity.
The mediator traveled to Juba and the son met the president and other stakeholders. But unfortunately, the first vice president was not consulted. You know, the Rome talks, the SPLM-IO is also a stakeholder. We were the ones who made the proposal to San Egidio when we visited the Pope. We made the proposal of having an inclusive peace, and this is how the forum came about. But now, with the talks moving to Nairobi and the mediator traveling to Juba, meeting the president and other stakeholders, minus meeting the first vice president, who is a key partner in this process, is a very big setback on the talks.
The meeting that's supposed to be held is with the holdout, is that correct?
Yeah, it's with the holdout group. But remember, the Artigonu is a collection of parties, and they have a delegation of the Artigonu which includes all the parties. But now the mediator traveled to Juba, met the president and other stakeholders, understand also met Tabande Ngai and Hissein Abdelbaghi, but did not meet the first vice president.
So if the talks take place, whatever decision is reached, will it impact the thinking of the first vice president?
We in the Artigonu is one delegation. But you remember, Artigonu is formed on the basis of collegial collaboration on very pertinent issue like the Rome talks process, which is ongoing in Nairobi. You expect the views of all the parties to be represented. So if the mediator was serious and cognizant of this fact, he should have gone not only to meet the president and the other vice presidents, but he should have also met the first vice president, who is the main stakeholder in the Artigonu and also in this process.
Nathaniel Oyet Piorino is the deputy chairman of the SPLMIO that is led by South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar. He spoke with me from Lusaka, Zambia. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 29th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Conflicts, extreme weather, and economic shocks are worsening global food insecurity, according to the United Nations. In a new report, the UN said global hunger rose in 2023 for the fifth year in a row, warning that millions more may go hungry in 2024. Tara Scully is Associate Professor of Biology and the Director of Curriculum Development for the new Global Food Institute at George Washington University. She tells viewers Jinedu Ofor that the food crisis is a global call to action.
We know that we've had a huge issue related to chronic hunger for a long time. Every country, including the United States. I mean, we have in D.C. where we have food apartheid, where we have consciously not made food accessible and good, healthy food, nutritious food to our people. Underlying issue with this report is the acute food and nutrition insecurity that we're facing. And it's due to conflict, and a lot of that conflict is due to climate change issues.
How much of this food insecurity and food starvation is man-made, and how much of it is natural, caused by climate change?
This is where it gets a little tricky, because in the world, there are only certain locations that can really produce enough food to feed the global population. And so you're not talking about, you know, in Gaza, they don't produce the food that they consume. In Haiti, they're not producing the food that they consume. All of these nations are trying to survive by importing a lot of food. And when that process gets cut off, then you have these issues. And so that is human-made, I would say, because we're choosing not to deliver the food, or we're choosing not to facilitate that food access for those nations.
In contrast, there's another report out of the UN talking about huge waste of food. One part of the world is starving. Another part is wasting enormous food that could otherwise have fed the hungry.
We have it from food production, so in the farms, we have that issue. And here at GW, we have different researchers who are trying to work with farmers about, like, how to have cold storage on the farm, like in African countries that don't have that access right now. And that's very helpful, but you have to do that all across the world. And most countries, especially in the global south, they don't have access to that type of infrastructure. And so you're going to have food waste on the farm, and then in transportation, and then in the grocery store, and then even at home. I mean, in the United States, it's almost like 38% of food waste is caused by people at home just not like consuming the food that they're buying and purchasing. And so we really need to figure out a culture around really appreciating all of the food that we have access to in, you know, our homes, in our restaurants, in our grocery stores.
That's Tara Scully, Associate Professor of Biology and Director of Curriculum Development for the new Global Food Institute at George Washington University. She was speaking with viewers Jinedu Ofor. Several people were reported missing Sunday evening after a boat capsized in Mororo, Bangale, Tana River County in Kenya. The Nation newspaper reports that the missing were crossing a flooded area from Madogo to Garissa town when the incident took place. Kenya and much of East Africa have been experiencing major flooding with death toll put at 76 for Kenya. Jeffrey Okoyo is the executive director of CFK Africa, an NGO that works with community members to improve public health, education outcomes, and economic opportunities in informal settlements in Kenya. He tells me the crisis in access to health care has been compounded by the major flooding across Kenya.
As you know, CFK Africa fights extreme poverty across informal settlements in Africa, and the ongoing rains across the country has caused a lot of devastation. First off, we've had lives lost, we've had livelihoods gone, and we've had the entire community ecosystem disrupted. So this has brought a lot of pain, suffering to a lot of residents of informal settlement in Kenya, specifically around informal settlements that are lacking of infrastructure necessary for them to be able to live normal lives. Really.
Besides the death toll, particularly Kenya, which we understand has gone to about, 76? What are some of the economic challenges as a result of the flooding?
We have had, of course, the death toll being officially announced at 76, but we, of course, also have reported cases of missing persons who've not been found. So we expect the death toll to unfortunately go high. We also have noted, regrettably, that a number of families have been wiped out literally. And this is quite evident in Madare and in Kibera, where the streams have overflown and literally wiped out businesses. We also know that the disruption and the poor infrastructure has led a lot of people not to be able to go to their places of work, and also the local kiosk and businesses have had to shut down. So the result or the impact of this is just unraveling. So we expect a lot of livelihoods to be disrupted by this.
What are some of the health issues that the communities that you work with are experiencing because of this flooding?
Like I did mention, we expect the water system to be contaminated, and this is going to, of course, pose rather a lot of danger to our water system, including drinking water. So we know as a country we've had an ongoing case of cholera, and there's also cases of dysentery that we are likely to get. And given the current medical strike that the country has, this is just going to pile up a lot of pressure to an already strained system.
Jeffrey Okoro is the executive director of CFK Africa. He spoke with me from the road between Western Kenya and Nairobi. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio has taken control of the country's Ministry of Energy, assisted by two deputy ministers. This follows the resignation on Friday of Minister Kanja Cisse amid a week-long electricity problem. Information Minister Cherno Ba denies that the Energy Minister, Cisse, is being scapegoated. He tells me that Cisse did the honorable thing to resign in the middle of a crisis.
It's true, and I think we've been very public about it, that the government was owing Car Powership, which is one of the providers of energy currently to the country, to the tune of about $40 million. We had arranged to be paying back, and there were other challenges as well in terms of distribution and maintaining distribution of electricity to our city. To the point that indeed Car Powership did shut down their supply to a significant portion of our city. And while we were trying to address all of that, the Minister of Energy, largely Dr. Kanja Cisse, I think did the honorable thing. In the middle of this crisis, he felt that he took responsibility and that he stepped aside. This is a man who has a long record of outstanding public service. But I think overall, what the public and the people of Sierra Leone wanted to hear was that responsibility had been taken. Two, our Ministry of Finance had negotiated and paid back just about 40% of what we owed, and power had been restored into the city, and we're hearing an array of very positive news about things that we're going to do able to address the long-term systemic problems, electricity generation and distribution in our country.
Minister Cisse's resignation, is this a way for the government to save face, or he did something wrong?
No. It's an acknowledgement of the fact that, yes, we've had challenges. This is why I said this has been, we're a very open and transparent government, and our president demands responsibility. In this case, he, one of his most trusted ministers, one of the longest-serving supporters of His Excellency, is the outgoing minister who tendered his resignation, and the president accepted it as the right thing to do. But keep in mind, again, that is just one thing. What has happened here is the government has managed, in the midst of ongoing financial constraints, to mobilize significant resources. We've paid back significantly the debts that we owe to car partnership. We're putting in place other long-term strategic solutions to address the challenges that we face in the energy sectors. Power has been restored into the city, but we understand that this is still just short-term. We're making sure that we don't pay where we're leaking electricity in and across the country because there are a lot of theft happening. We're putting in place new strategies. The president himself has said this is such a critical issue that for the next foreseeable future, he is going to be in charge of the ministry. He will be our Minister of Energy, and he's bringing new actors, new players. He's mobilizing additional resources. And I think the people of Sierra Leone can be confident that, yes, while it is not going to be an automatic solution to the long-term problem, but we're doing what we need to do to address this.
John Abad, the Sierra Leone's Information Minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Algeria, where for the second straight week, an African Confederations Cup match between Renaissance Bakani of Morocco and Algerian side USM Alger was cancelled in a dispute over a map on the Moroccan team's shirts. The Confederation of African Football awarded Bakani a 3-0 victory in the first leg of the semi-final, cancelled last Sunday when the Moroccan club refused to take to the field after Algerian officials confiscated their shirts. On Sunday in Bakane, only the home players took the field and they saluted their fans as the stadium announcer told the crowd the match had been cancelled. Moroccan television reported that the USM team left the stadium just before the scheduled kick-off. The row began when the Moroccan squad arrived in Algeria last week ahead of the first leg tie. Custom officials confiscated Bakani's shirt on the grounds that they carried a map of Morocco that included the disputed Western Sahara. Staying with the Confederations Cup, Zamalek of Egypt won their CAF Confederations Cup semi-final away leg by a record margin as they defeated Dreams of Ghana 3-0 in the second leg in Kumasi on Sunday. The White Knights won the tie 3-0 on aggregate after a goalless first leg in the Egyptian capital last Sunday. Zamalek bettered the previous best away result in the penultimate stage, a 3-1 victory by SuperSport United of South Africa against Club Africain of Tunisia 7 seasons ago. And now to rugby news, where Kenya is the 2024 Barts Cup champions. Kenya emerged victorious after beating host and defending champions Zimbabwe 28-13 on Sunday evening at the Harare Sports Club in Harare, Zimbabwe. The tournament, played in a round-robin format, culminated in Kenya's triumph after registering 3 consecutive wins. In athletics, world 800-meter silver medalist Emmanuel Wanyoye stepped up to the mile in style, breaking the world road mile record with 3 minutes 54.56 seconds at the Atzero Road to Records event in Germany on Saturday. Deciding to make his mile debut rather than raise his specialist distance, the Kenyan 19-year-old improved the previous world record of 3 minutes 56.13 seconds set by USA's Hobbs Kessler at the World Athletics Road Running Championships Riga 2023 in October. Kessler on this occasion was second, chasing Wanyoye over the finish line in 3 minutes 56.18 seconds, while South Africa's Rian Mafilele was third in 3 minutes 56.45 seconds.
I feel so happy for today. It's not just that I try to push myself, then my coach will tell me it is possible to break world record 1 mile. My coach told me if you run up to 200 meters to go, you can win this race.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, April 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.